Good morning. Let's start here. Birdsong with Sean Ronayne on Lyric.
A friend once described today's bird to me as sequined little smarty pants. And as diminutive as this may sound, it is in fact quite apt. Starlings, at first glance, are a plain black monochrome little bird. But look closer and they'll blow you away. In winter, their feathers are donned with silver sequin-like specks throughout. And in summer, these flashy little sequins float in a sea of purple and green iridescence. And if that isn't enough, starlings are also amazing mimics. Starlings are lifelong song learners, unlike some other birds who have a critical learning window of a few months before their songs are crystallized for life, set in stone. As starlings have the propensity to continue updating their song, they perfect it and polish it over their entire lifetimes. The longest lived starling on record is 22 years and 11 months, so you can only imagine what a song that bird must have had. I'm honoured to have had a starling nest above our very own front door. Every morning the male would sing his heart out, and I kept a good ear for changes over the seasons. Would I hear him add to his repertoire? Well, I did. When the foxes began to mate in the garden, he soon added fox screams to his song. When snipe began to migrate overhead at night in earnest, these two were added to the track list. But best of all is that this starling began to mimic me. It learned to mimic my daily ritual of calling my dog Toby back in from the garden. Come here. Come here. Complete with Cork accent. So, follow your local starling and see if you can identify these mimicking masters.
What a lovely piece of radio. Sean Ronayne on Lyric. And yes, we have the longer, brighter days finally here. Dare we call it spring? Cue this annual scrap.
Well, we get to the controversial bit now straight away, because the minute you start talking about spring, there's an argument over when it starts, Shane.
A.K.A. Dr. Bergen from UCD.
Yeah, I love it. I really do. And I'm an optimist. So February 1st is very much the start of spring for me.
But it wouldn't be a scrap without some fighting factions. First up, those meteorologists.
Well, meteorologists, of course, think about the weather and about climate. So for countries like Ireland, which is kind of mid-latitude, between halfway between the pole and the equator, we have four seasons. And meteorologists would say that the summer months are the warmest ones. Sounds obvious, right? The winter ones are the coolest. And then we have the in-between or shoulder seasons. And so for definition for spring for them is the 1st of March, because the warmest 3 months are June, July and August.
Right.
Yeah. So, but of course, that kind of jars with what I said a minute ago. But it is technically correct as well.
And then we have those astronomers. Different again.
So astronomers think about the Earth as an object that goes around the sun. And by definition, it takes 1 year for the Earth to go around the sun. And in terms of how that mixes with seasons, it's a commonly held misconception that in the summertime, the Earth is closer to the sun. That's not true at all, because if it were, when it's summer in the northern hemisphere, it would also be summer in the southern hemisphere, and ditto for winter. We know that when it's summer here, it's winter in Australia and vice versa. So there's something else going on. In fact, the reason that we get seasons is that the Earth is tilted either away from the sun or toward the sun. And in the summertime, the northern hemisphere for us is tilted toward the sun. So on any given day, you have a longer period of light. And also the sun is more intense. Mm-hmm. It's higher in the sky. So you get the full belt of the sun on our faces. And for most of us, that's completely enjoyable. We would say then that the 3 months of the most amount of light are the summer. And when you work that out, you can think about the periods of extreme day, extreme night, and the in-between bits. So the solstice that happens in December, of course, Newgrange being the key one there, and of course in June. And then you have the equinoxes, which means equal amounts of night and day in March and in, October. And so spring for the astronomer is the 21st or the 20th of March, depending on...
Confused. Need more coffee and an answer. We have the 1st of March now, we have the 20th or 21st.
No, it's getting later and later.
But you came in here saying the 1st of February. So what's your own logic for the 1st of February being the start
date? I think the ancient Irish were onto something here because they looked at the amount of the solar levels, right? And so the 1st of February is roughly halfway between the darkest day and the spring equinox. And so for them, that's a really kind of important hinge point or turning point when you're kind of moving toward the light. And so I think perhaps the Celts were onto something here. There is a logic to that starting date. It's a kind of a halfway turning point. We're turning the corner towards the brightness and the warmth of spring.
Phew, we'll take it. But with spring firmly established on the Nature on One programme on Bank Holiday Monday, biologist Terry Flanagan celebrated the red fox, and up popped Aintony Launa.
The Irish word for a fox is shinnock, and there are some who say that the word shenanigans comes from this Irish word. Now, shenanigans is hopping about and leaping about and doing smart and clever things and having fun. And this apparently is a reflection of the fox itself, who is smart and clever and seems to be having lots of fun as well. There's an early Irish text that describes the three most harmful animals found in Ireland. There was the wolf, there was the fox, and there was the mouse, actually. That was the third most harmful one. It probably ate all the grain and things like that. But the skill of the fox, of course, the cunningness, the cleverness of the fox was also recognised. The animal could steal past the shepherds. The animal was difficult to, when you were hunting it, to follow its trail in a bank or a woodland, because the way the foxes walk, they have a very neat gait. And if you look at the foxes' trails, you don't see 4 feet. They walk on their own footprint. So the trail of a fox along is quite different. And of course, the fox looks straight ahead and just catches in the left and the right with his eyes. So these, the way he moved and the way he saw was apparently a wonderful, elegant, light way to move. And the most famous horse of Finn McCool was told that his horse had the gait of a fox, and this was actually a compliment to be so neat and light and masterful. So as a result, Irish folklore is full of stories about how the fox outwitted man.
And just have a listen to how clever they are in ridding themselves of pests. Just the start of their prowess.
And the fox had an ingenious method of getting rid of fleas.
They take a big lump of moss, probably sphagnum or something like that, into their mouth, and then the fox reverses back into the river or into a pond, I suppose. And as he gets into the water, the fleas all come towards him because the fleas don't want to be drowned, and they come up towards his head, and then they all jump onto the moss. Then the fox dumps the moss in the water and is...
He swims away.
He's free of all his fleas. So this is very clever. But not only is the fox good at curing himself, apparently bits of the fox were very good for curing ailments of humans. And there's great ones. One cure for infertility for a woman, you'll be glad to know, she was to sprinkle sugar on the testicles of a fox and roast them in the oven. I presume she'd have taken them off the fox by this stage. She should then eat the testicles before her main meal for 3 days in succession, and that would fix her. Mother of God, I mean, the smell of a fox is bad enough, but can you imagine what the roasted testicles would smell like? Now, how do you think of that? Would you rather be infertile? I don't know. I think I might decide, if God had decided I was infertile, I don't think I'd be putting sugar on a fox's goodies.
Lovely. From the Nature on One programme. And even Morning Ireland were getting in on the act.
This item will no doubt give the heebie-jeebies to a number of listeners, because we are talking about zombie spiders.
Bring it on, Mary. Bring it on. Zombie spiders in caves in Cavan, Fermanagh, Monaghan. Here is Tim Fogg, a professional cave explorer and part of the team that discovered them. Sound effects our own.
Tell me about these spiders, and what turns them from cave-dwelling spiders into zombies?
The spiders are common cave spiders. They're quite a big spider. They're about 5 centimetres across, and they live in cave entrances. And some of them get infected with a fungi, which it affects their behaviour in such a way that they come out of the crevices in the cave and come out onto the walls. And at that stage, the fungus kills them, and then their spores come out, and because they're out on the walls, the spores get blown about in the draft and therefore reinfect other spiders. So it's an extraordinary story, really, because this is a fungi which has no nervous system, no brain or anything, but it's able to manipulate with chemicals the behaviour of the spiders.
But they haven't made it, well, as far as the pale, have they? Now, that would be serious.
Are they confined to Cavan and Monaghan? And is this fungus you're talking about confined to these caves, or could we find it all over the country?
No, well, I'm sure we could if we looked. It's not that easy to see or to find. You have to look fairly hard. At present, we've looked over Sligo and Cavan and Leitrim, and we've found examples in most of those. I'm sure if we look harder, we can find them around other places. The interesting thing is actually at present, we only have them in Ireland. We haven't found this species anywhere else. And of course, it's a new species of fungi.
And these spiders, I mean, they come to a nasty end because of this fungus. Should we be worried here? Does it have a wider danger and application?
No, I don't. I think we should be delighted in many ways. These fungi do contain a lot of very interesting chemicals, and it's obviously quite an interesting process that's allowing this manipulation to happen. So, and actually, samples of this fungi have now been stored for medical research, because all sorts of things are coming out from fungi into medical research that are helping us with various diseases and things, well, including cancer.
We look forward to following the future of the zombie spiders of Cavan and Fermanagh.
Do we, Mary? Really? But then, to complete the menagerie, bats, a misunderstood creature and long maligned. But on a mission to change all that, embrace the bat, Niamh Roach, Senior Project Manager with Bat Conservation Ireland. And first off, a few facts.
So bats are mammals.
They are mammals, yeah. Right. Yeah. So warm-blooded, give birth to live babies. And
which are called?
Pups.
Pups,
yeah,
right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't lay eggs. They feed their babies milk, and they're warm-blooded most of the time.
Okay. How many breeds of bats do we have in this country?
So we have nine species in Ireland.
Species, sorry, not breeds,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, but so there's about 40 plus in Europe as a whole, and we have nine.
And the smallest and the biggest?
They're all really small.
Are they?
They're all really tiny. Like the pipistrelles would be the smallest. They only weigh about 5 grams, which is about the same as like a euro coin.
It's a tablespoon.
Yeah, not even a tablespoon. You know, right. It's really tiny.
Oh, a tablespoon is 15.
Yeah,
sorry, a teaspoon.
Yeah. Teaspoon, yeah.
Teaspoon, yes.
Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
Sorry.
So like tiny, but with their wings outstretched then, you know, they do look bigger.
Yeah.
But they're very light. So then our biggest would be a bat called Leisler's bat, and they have a wingspan of about 30 centimetres, about your ruler, but they only weigh, again, about 12 grams, you know, so they're really light.
So they glide, do they?
They flap. It's powered flight. So they're one of their distinctive things is that they're the only mammal that can do true powered flight.
Oh, right, so they're flapping.
Yeah, so they flap. So it means that they can go up, you know, like a flying squirrel can open its kind of skin and
but they're
glide.
Gliding. Yes,
they're
yes,
gliding,
yes,
but
yes.
They can't flap their wings.
Okay,
fly.
Very interesting. Oh, and this.
Final myth, blind as a bat.
Only when they're born for a few days.
There you go.
But not all of us love a bat. This emboldened texter got in touch.
Maureen has been on. These bats are driving me batty. I swear they have raves nightly in the eaves. Sometimes they grace us with their presence in the sitting room or kitchen.
Okay.
And we called out the Batman to help. Bad idea. Now they know we have them. We are not allowed to stop them getting in.
Okay.
They're a protected species. I want them gone yesterday. Thank you.
Okay, so obviously this lady's having some troubles. I would say, I would guess this time of the year the bats aren't making any noise at all because they're hibernating.
Okay.
So it would probably just be in a fairly short window in the summertime, which is when they're active.
Mating, is it? No.
So, well, mating usually takes place in autumn and the females become pregnant in the spring. And it's when the females gather then in what we call a nursery or maternity roost. Now, they give birth there. They only have one pup, so they don't reproduce like mice or rabbits, you know. So it means that when you have a roost of bats, you might have a lot of the local population of that particular type of bat in your attic. Right. So we do try and ask people to be tolerant for those few weeks while the bats are present. Now, obviously, sometimes they do continue to cause problems and people do have genuine phobias. And in that case, we would suggest that you contact your local National Parks and Wildlife Service to discuss options.
And if you are up the attic and wondering just what you're dealing with, well, never let it be said, we did not bring you all the information.
How does their droppings differ from mice?
So this is where you need to crush a dropping.
Oh, great. As opposed to a grape.
So you crush it. If it's dust, if it turns into dust, it's a bat dropping. If it's hard, it's a mouse dropping. If it's all slimy, then it's a fresh mouse dropping and you're really sorry that you've done that. So the bat droppings are just made up of all the indigestible pieces of insects, you know.
So it's powdery.
So it turns into powder.
Right, interesting.
Also, if there's a lot of droppings, if you put down plastic, gather them up. They are fantastic fertiliser.
If you might be so inclined. Back in a bit. Welcome back. It's almost unbelievable and not in a good way. But there are still thousands of homes without power in the aftermath of Storm Éowyn. And yes, crews doing their best, but what hell for those people still without power. And all the while, costs are rising. On Tuesday, Claire put this to the CEO of the ESB, Paddy Hayes.
Now, what about compensation? Is it time that we looked at a robust compensation scheme for people? In Scotland, if you're an electricity customer and you have an outage, you get £85 if you've no power for 48 hours, and that's up to a maximum of 2,000. We should have that here, shouldn't we?
Well, we have a scheme at the moment, a charter payment scheme, where in the normal course of events, if customers are out because of an issue with the network, there are some charter payments. That doesn't apply to storms. And what instead, I think the government has stepped forward and offered a humanitarian assistance scheme for customers who are out of power, who have been impacted by that. And I think that's the appropriate way to do it.
Well, I'm sure you would say that, because it means that the ESB isn't paying anything.
Well, I think the schemes in the UK, what actually happens is, as I understand it, that a customer will get paid a payment if they're out under a storm, but ultimately that cost of that payment is ultimately recovered by the networks company and ultimately paid for by all customers. So it's a socialisation.
All ESB customers would have to pay for that, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And therefore, I think the most appropriate place for this, which the governments have taken on, is the humanitarian assistance.
So what will people get back then? You mentioned that there is some sort of payment charter there.
There is a payment charter in normal times, but
it doesn't apply. So nothing, not even the public service levy?
No, that doesn't apply during storm situation. Again, for the reason that I've said, which is that ultimately, overall, those costs would be recovered from customers generally and would increase the cost base.
Not looking good. But Claire went back in.
We've got 400 international crews. We've got a team of about 1,300 people in working behind the scenes, supporting
supply
chain. Yeah, but
listeners to this would say, so you should. You know, you're a company that made huge profits, over 800 million in 2023. And you're saying, no, we're not going to give anything to the people who are freezing and their contents of their freezer and their fridge gone. Some people are staying in hotels out of their own pockets.
And that the government has stepped up, and there's been a whole of government approach to this, Claire, which offers the humanitarian assistance scheme, which, as I understand it, will and can compensate people for the cost of alternative accommodation. And the most important thing that we can do, and we're trying to do it, and we're doing it, is getting customers back connected with our electricity.
So nothing from the ESB in terms of help to buy a loaf of bread or to go and buy a hot meal. You got to go to the government to get that. That's your bottom line on that.
Yeah, what we are doing is restoring supply to the customers who are out, and we are doing that to the utmost of our ability.
And the ESB too is incurring costs. So how will this be covered?
Have you got a handle on how much this is going to cost the ESB?
No, I'm not sure how much it's going to cost yet, but it will be significant. It will cost tens of millions.
And what will that do in terms of the cost of electricity and the bills for everybody?
Well, ultimately, that's something that gets scrutinised. And in 2026, it's likely that that will those charges which are allowed there will find their way back into the overall cost of our distribution system network.
OK, so prices will go up, you feel, in the aftermath of this storm?
Well, there is a cost associated with this that will ultimately be borne by across the electricity network as a whole.
Paddy Hayes, CEO of the ESB. Meanwhile, the Donald, or rather President Donald Trump, has been mightily busy this week, slapping tariffs on all and sundry, and then vowing to turn Gaza into the Riviera of the Middle East. Your head will be spinning, so hard to keep up. But let's start with Gaza. On Morning Ireland, Sean Whelan gave his analysis of the thinking behind this proposal.
Well, his thinking is, let's think outside the box. Let's just get all the people in Gaza who have nowhere to live, who are just in a hellhole, as he described it, of rubble, get them out of there, get them into new housing to be built somewhere in the Middle East, presumably Egypt and Jordan. Even though the leaders there have said no, he thinks they can be prevailed upon to give them land. He thinks the Saudis can cough up the money for it, and that America would then take charge of the Gaza Strip and redevelop it as an international city, and that this would provide the security that Israel seeks. It would provide the people of Gaza with beautiful, top-of-the-range, custom-designed settlements to live in. There'd be something in it for everybody, something except the one big glaring omission, and that is a Palestinian state. And he really had very little to say about a Palestinian state in the future.
OK, so the US takes over Gaza, moves the displaced people out again and creates a Riviera of the Middle East. Is he serious?
Seems to be.
And that was the question on the lips of many. With Claire Shoshank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist.
There was an interesting suggestion from the Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, who feels that this is a distraction, that he will have succeeded in distracting everyone from the real story, the billionaire seizing government to steal from regular people.
Well, I think it's not incumbent on senators to tell us what is and is not the real story. I think a president calling for the ethnic cleansing of a territory in the Middle East is absolutely newsworthy, and we must cover it and discuss it, as you know, both of you and I are news professionals. However, it is also true that the administration in its early days is making a very large number of quite radical moves across the board in foreign policy and domestic policy. And the executive branch in America, the administrative state, is being transformed by Elon Musk. People are being fired. Agencies like the FBI and CIA are being purged. Data is being removed from sensitive government servers. These are incredibly important stories. But I think with Donald Trump, given his proclivities, given his his attitude towards provocative announcements, we must learn over the coming years to be able to discuss multiple stories at once, to be able to walk and chew gum, as they say.
Does it leave the ceasefire in a more precarious position this morning?
Well, it would, of course. The ceasefire, you know, does not call for the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. And if it did, Hamas and would never have agreed to it. Palestinians would never have endorsed it. I'm sure even many Israelis would have had their serious qualms about this. Mm. And so all in all, yes, I think it'll play havoc with diplomatic efforts. And I will only know.
And as you might expect, this was the reaction from Palestinian Ambassador to Ireland, Dr. Gillian Waba Abdelmajid, on Morning Ireland.
Any Palestinian on this earth will reject any plan to displace the Palestinian. This is our land, and no one on earth can uproot us from this land. We belong there, and we will remain there.
But again and again, the return to that question of credibility. On the News at One, Rachel put this to Middle East correspondent Borzu Gurahi.
Borzu, there's so much noise coming from the Trump administration at the moment that it can be hard to know what's serious and what's not. How seriously, in your assessment, should we take this?
Not seriously. I think it's a non-starter in the U.S., given the U.S. Drift towards isolationism that even Trump has propagated and his attempts to roll back U.S. foreign operations and U.S. foreign aid operations. I think it's a non-starter in the Middle East. I think it's a non-starter in the European Union, which is focused, as the Irish foreign minister was saying, on the two-state solution or some kind of a reconstruction effort inside Gaza. So I think it's just noise more than anything. And we've been through this before. Maybe the news media needs to remember what it was like 4 years ago when there was regular eruptions from the White House.
And while much of the Trump-related news this week was in the land of the hypothetical, for Overseas Development Agency USAID, there were very real impacts of the new presidency, all overseen by one Elon Musk. With Claire, Simon Marks, chief correspondent of Feature Story News in Washington.
USAID, by far and away, with a $40 billion of taxpayer money to disperse every year, the biggest single name in the international humanitarian and development assistance game. And Elon Musk essentially has closed it. I mean, there was a standoff in the USAID offices as Musk's team sought to take control of the department's computer systems, including classified information that was contained in them. He eventually succeeded in having the two long-term veterans of USAID who were trying to safeguard those computer systems placed on administrative leave. Musk and his department colleagues then started going through the full list of AID expenditure all over the world and basically, in Elon Musk's own words, began feeding the entire agency to the wood chipper. So over the course of the last week, USAID has come to a complete standstill. Its employees were all told to stay home. All over the world, thousands of USAID employees and contractors are being told that they must fly home. Programs have been halted in midstream, immediately shut down. Notionally, the department continues to exist. Notionally, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is now running it, but it's apparent that they're going to lay off all but about 290 of USAID's 10,000 staff around the world, and to all intents and purposes, the agency dispersing 40% of the world's humanitarian and development assistance money has ceased to exist.
From the Claire Byrne Show yesterday. But earlier in the week, the threat of tariffs of 25% on goods from Canada and Mexico imported into the US. Then a bit of a deal, and those tariffs were put on hold for 30 days. But the 10% tariffs on goods from China did go ahead and were met with counter tariffs of up to 15%. Former Trump White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer joined Cormac.
I wonder, is Trump and the administration being taken as a sucker in one way? Because what he got from Mexico for this temporary reprieve on tariffs is to tighten the border a little bit, which was announced before he came to power anyway, and more action on drugs, which was being done anyway. So they just repackaged announcements and said, there you go.
Yeah, we'll see. It's a 30-day reprieve. But at the end of the day, I think, you know, I can tell you just from what I saw, enough people recognize that the mere threat of it was going to get things done. The conversations are ongoing. I think Mexico and Canada clearly understand the impact that these kind of measures would have mm-hmm. on their economy. And look, as I said, you know, I know everyone loves to wring their hands about some of the tactics, but this is, you know, this was sort of the message that the most of the media, both here domestically and definitely over abroad, missed in this election.
Okay, I wonder, can you say where people are wringing their hands and look, terrible tactics from Trump? Are we not beyond that a little bit? Are we not?
Who's we?
Everybody who's observing Trump 2.0. We realise that his tactics are sensationalist. Has he not been shown up by Canada and Mexico to be a little bit of a blowhard here, to be a bluffer? The first offer, and he backs down.
No, it wasn't the first offer he backed down. He got what he wanted. I mean, Canada's putting serious money and serious tactics behind protecting the border, the flow of drugs and in immigration in. If it doesn't work, if Trudeau doesn't back it up in the next 30 days and show he's sincere, or Sheinbaum in Mexico, then it'll go into effect. I don't know how you you perceive it that way, but that's unfortunate because, again, I think the prevailing attitude that many in the media like you have misses where I think most of the electorate is in the United States. So I mean, you can, again, you can fixate on the tactics, but you're missing the boat.
Okay.
Once again.
From Drive Time, back in a bit. Welcome back. Us Irish, traditionally kind of good at losing. Asher, what can you do? They just didn't suit you. But Ireland 2025 and winning, not a bother it seems. We give you Cork's Cian Ducrow, who took home a Grammy for his work as one of the songwriters on Saturn by SZA. And the whole thing, yes, it was a bit of a blur, but the mammy suitably unfazed.
Passage west to the Grammys. So who was the first person you called?
I don't even know, to be honest. I didn't really have... I mean, I was with my girlfriend and two of my best friends, and I called... I texted my manager, but she already knew because she was watching it live. And I mean, everybody knew, like, before I knew, everyone was watching it. So yes. They all kind of were just like, my phone was just exploding. And then I was having to go and do loads of press for a few hours straight after. So it was like, it was a bit of a whirlwind until the next morning. I got to like call my mom and all of that and chat to my brother and stuff. But it's crazy.
What did your mom say?
I don't even know, to be honest. Just the usual, like, you know, well done. You'll have to explain to me what it means.
What's a Grammy? What's a Grammy?
Yeah, she was like, do you split it in? Because there was like some photos, you know, of us with one. Obviously, we all get a Grammy each, but in some of the photos, we're all holding one together.
Yes.
And she was like, do you have to share it then, the Grammy, or split it in four or five or whatever? And I was like, no, Mum, we all get one.
A bit like the Sam Maguire Keen that you'd have it for a week or so and then you'd have to give it back. So you get your own Grammy to bring home and to Passage West and put it on the mantelpiece.
Exactly.
Really impressive. And at least he wasn't propping up the bar, unlike some people. Yes, we're talking about you, composer and conductor Emer Noon, aided and abetted in music and life by your husband Craig Stewart Garfinkel. And their score for World of Warcraft was up for a Hollywood Music in Media Award. So yeah, they were on high stools in the lobby.
You want to tell them about that story, about how we didn't think we were going to win?
Oh my gosh.
I'll let you talk because it's embarrassing.
It's terrible. He's just, Sean, you can't have the two of us on again. This is terrible.
I'm going to insist from now on.
We were at the Hollywood Music and Media Awards and we were up against... himself, Sir Paul, had done the video game Destiny, and I just assumed, you know, we're on a night out. Yeah. The kids, we had a young baby at the time. It was our first night out in forever, and we'd assumed that there's no way we're going to win this against a Beatles. So we proceeded to the bar where we stayed for the vast majority of the evening, and then lo and behold, we blooming well won the thing.
The names. Yeah.
And there was a fellow composer there as well who'd worked on it, a friend of mine, Neil Acree. So Neil and Craig and I went up to get the award, and the two boys go, Emer, you talk.
Oh, of course they did, yeah.
Being Irish, you know, it's amazing.
No,
you managed it.
No, you don't understand. We were drunk. Then she was stone cold sober. She gave the most magnificent speech. She called out all the producers. She dedicated the award to Neil's dad, who had just passed away. All of this is wonderful. And the second she steps away from the microphone, we're all drunk again.
There you go.
We're taking the pictures, and they had to tell us to be quiet because we're making too much noise. I do
have to ask you. Oh, they were very charming. And when they met, Stravinsky was the bonder and the deal breaker.
You like to nerd out, to use that wonderful phrase, on the great composer, even on your honeymoon?
Oh my God. We are both massive Stravinsky fans. I actually found my very first concert poster the other day from the Trinity Orchestra, and there was, of course,
Dumbarton Oaks.
Yeah, Dumbarton Oaks. Stravinsky was on the very first concert I did. But we went to the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées where the famous riot happened. Mm-hmm. And there's a fabulous... Well, there was
you then have to explain it from the Rite of Spring.
From the Rite
of
Spring.
For the Rite of Spring,
yeah. And there's a fabulous restaurant, Michelin-starred restaurant, on the top of the building. And yeah, that's where we went on our honeymoon. Total nerds. It's very bad. Oh my God.
Yes, there is nothing more romantic than listening to The Rite of Spring.
Well, it has a certain sensuality in sections, let's be honest.
Oh, there absolutely is. Before I met Emer, there was one woman I played The Rite of Spring for her. And she's like, what is that? That sounds awful. And I said, okay, this is done. She didn't get it. That's all right.
From Arena and with Marty Morrissey on Bank Holiday Monday, How to Gael podcast presenters Louise Cantillon and Siobhan O'Rourke. The Changa, by the way, female.
I love Siobhan, that you call her.
Do you know what? Everyone picks up on this. In Irish, so Gaeilge, nouns are masculine or feminine, and Gaeilge is feminine. She's a feminine noun. So as Gaeilge, I would refer to her as she. Mm-hmm. So Saverla, I also say she. I think it suits her though, doesn't it, Marty?
Well, 100%. I love her as well. I'll start calling Gaeilge her as well.
Do.
Agus bíag éisteacht for some pretty nifty fuckle.
Right, so on Ciarán atá agam sa this, the one I have for you is Rógaracht.
Rógaracht.
Rógaracht, and it means divilment, Marty.
Divilment, I like that word. Yourself, yeah. I do, yeah. Rógaracht.
Rógaracht, there you go. Now,
I like the strong R.
Now, will you use that in your next three broadcasts, please, Marty? That's your challenge for
Rógaracht.
Today. Rógaracht.
So particularly when Limerick are playing, when Louise is beside you there.
There you go. Yeah. Plenty of rogues to be talking about there, Marty. I'll give you this one, right. Ma Jan Vaher, down in a place called Ballyhaig in Kerry, had a great word that was gubble, okay?
Gubble.
Gubble. It almost sounds funny to say in your mouth, gubble. And it means like a rag or a little piece of fluff or lint that might be on a coat, right? And apparently, if you had a little gubble or the gansey and there was something hanging off your jumper, it would mean you have an admirer. So you can check your gansey there now and see.
Well, I'm looking at it here right now.
That'd be a great magic trick.
It would be, absolutely. We'll do two more. I'm enjoying this. Siobhan, give me another one.
Okay. You've put me here and spot the niche, Marty. Right, okay. So this one's an insect. Oh, do you know what? I'll give you the English first and you tell me if you know which insect it is, right?
Okay, go for it.
So the English means little cow of God.
Little cow of God.
Yeah. So as Gaeilge, it's Boeing Day, right?
Boeing Day.
Boeing Day. Can you guess what insect I'm referring to?
I haven't got a clue. Give me a hint.
It's only the humble ladybird.
The humble ladybird,
yes,
really?
She's our little cow of God. She is, yeah.
I love the translation. Yeah. Okay, Louise, lay it on me. Last one.
So I often say it about you, Marty. You've lovely freckles over your nose, especially in a nice sunny day down in Cusack Park. And
flattery will get you everywhere, Louise.
Don't I know? Yeah.
Look where
she's
got
this far.
Yeah.
So I tell you, there's a lovely fuckle as you'll get for freckles, and it's Pogini Graina, and it literally translates to kisses from the sun.
Pogini Graina.
There you go.
Marty Morrissey on Monday. And now to an item frankly just made for Radio Reaction. This week making the news, a French state agency recommended taking her handy when it comes to washing clothes. Better for the environment. Their advice, 30 wears for jeans, 7 for bras, 5 for t-shirts, 3 for sports gear. Drive Time went at it.
Thank you very much for that. Lots and lots and lots of you getting in touch to 51551 about clothes and when you wash them and when you don't. And yeah, I must say you have very different views out there. Shay says, I wash my jeans after 2 days. 30 would gross me out, says Shay. Now, I think two. Honestly, you can get more than 2 days out of a pair of jeans unless something awful happens. Another person says, I use the smell test. When it smells, wash it. It's a pretty good rule to go by. Anne says, I have never washed my jeans in over a year. It ruins the fabric, says Anne. I can get a week for a top. Well, Anne, that's good going, I suppose. Another person says, I last washed my jeans months ago. I've been wearing them to work every day. They're perfectly fine. I mean, are they though? Have you smelled them? Are you sure they're perfectly fine? And then another Anne has texted to say, 1 day for underwear, twice for t-shirts, 4 or 5 for jeans, twice for socks, gym gear, rinse after use, white blouses once, colour shirts twice, and bed clothes about every week. It sounds like Anne literally has a list of every item of clothing and how she does it. And thank you for sending that list to us, Anne. You can keep all those texts coming to 51551. I mean, it really is fascinating getting an insight into your laundry. And I mean that genuinely. But we're going to move on now because...
Ah, but if you're looking for insights, well, it has to be Liveline. Knocking smelly socks out of it. With Katie, here's Mike.
I have a story to tell you.
Go on.
I admit it, which is true, maybe a couple of years ago, that I never wash towels.
You never wash towels?
Well, maybe once a month. Right. People said, what's the logic? And I said, well, I'm good at washing myself for you. You come out of a shower, you're supposed to wash yourself. So why do you need to wash the towel?
Fair point, sir, and a whole new perspective. Next up, Diane.
You don't wear any bra at all. What about the rest of the undergarments? Would they be seeing the inside of the washing machine very often?
They'd be seeing I probably get about 2 days' wear, maybe. Then change and have a bit of a wipe down so that it.
My God.
So I do a little bit of a hand wash as well between showers. I mean, we shower about once a week on average. It could be maybe once every 4.
You're pulling my leg now, Diane. Are you? You'd only have a shower once a week.
Yeah. Seriously. No, I'm not saying I don't wash in other manners, but we'd only have a shower once a week, and we don't have a bath. So. It's shower only. And like I say, about once a week, and that's perfectly fine.
You must use very little hot water in your house.
Yeah, not a lot, no. And in fairness, I mean, I haven't heard anyone come up to me and say, God, you stink, when was your last bath? About 5 years ago.
But it is to Mary we turn for true commitment, for she had a whole washing system.
I'm old-fashioned. I have an outside sink at the back of the kitchen. And I use it for everything. So I steep my clothes in an outside sink, and I only rinse in a cold rinse in the washing machine and the spin. That's all I do.
So you don't actually use the washing machine to wash your clothes at all?
Well, I do. Now and again I do, but I think my clothes are cleaner the way I do them. The spotless coming out of the sink and out of the spin dryer, yeah. I have a washing machine now, but I only do a cold rinse in it.
Hardcore. And this really did turn into a conversation with no boundaries whatsoever.
How often would you wash your pyjamas, Mary?
No, I wash my underwear regularly and all that, but I don't wash my bra every day. I wear my bra for about a week, but my other underwear I wash every day. You know, I change every day.
Would you go? Because there are people who will say it's bad for you to wash yourself with soap every day.
Well, I don't shower every day now. I only shower every 2 weeks, but I wash in between. Look, I wash every day in between.
Right. And that would be, would that I be like know, yeah. a, what do they call that, a cat's wash at
well,
the sink?
A good cat, it would be a good cat's wash, actually.
Right. would you be sharing your hygiene habits with other people? Would you ever have a conversation with people and get a reaction to them about how you feel about...
Well, I don't discuss it with other... I don't talk about it, you know. I just get on with it, you know.
Until you phoned Liveline. And that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.